You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the political history of the word elite.
First, the upcoming spring election in Wisconsin in April features mostly local offices and candidates, but there are two statewide races on the ballot that our next guest says could further the state's shift to the right. In the wake of the election, which gave Republicans historic majorities in the Assembly and in the Senate, he says that the last resort of Wisconsin's left has been the court system, and now a Republican Supreme Court justice is running unopposed.
Avner Zarny joins us. Joins us now. He's a longtime Wisconsinite who's semi-retired from the aerospace industry. He's an ordained rabbi and contributor for PJ Media. Avner, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
So this is not one of your high-profile elections, these spring elections in Wisconsin, but a couple of important races. A big picture, why do you think these elections will continue Wisconsin's shift to the right?
Well, it's very interesting. If you take a look at the general pattern as it's been playing out in the country, I've often said for many years that Wisconsin is in many ways a microcosm of the United States. So we've always been on the knife's edge, 50% Democrat, 50% Republican, and of course things have always swayed back and forth. But 2010 was a very real sea change in that, if you think about it, just before the November election, all but one statewide office were in Democratic hands. The only one that wasn't was the Attorney General. When the dust settled after the election was over, all but three statewide offices were now in Republican hands, and the Republicans had shifted the control of the legislature completely, which had previously been had Democratic majorities in both houses. So that's a quite incredible shift for just one election. And the fact of the matter is that it's not been balanced out. It's been continuing ever since then. In the 2012 election, the 2014 election, of course, there was the recall of Governor Walker, and now the 2016 election, the Republicans have retained control of all of the major organs in the state.
And then we've got these hypothetically nonpartisan elections, things like superintendent of education and state Supreme Court. In reality, these are pretty much partisan proxy wars, aren't they?
Well, of course that's true. It's certainly become more and more true. It was once the case. There's a famous quotation from the late George Wallace that I think actually used to have some validity. He once said that there's not a dime's worth of difference between them, when he was speaking about the Republicans and the Democrats, and the reason was that both parties were simply vehicles for getting people elected. That certainly has changed over the last 50 years or so, and both parties have become much more ideological, both on the national level and also on the state level, and I think that it's showing.
Do you think that's a good thing, that we have a distinct ideological choice versus, two closer to the center parties that mainly just want to get elected?
Not necessarily, because it makes it harder and harder for them to be able to unify the electorate once it's over. If in the previous scenario, if you had two parties that were more or less to the center, one slightly right of center, one slightly left of center, maybe, and one of them won, so if one of them won, it somehow wasn't a catastrophe to the other side that he had won. As things are right now, I think that there are very significant elements on both sides that view each election as a war. I certainly think that that's playing out in the presidential election, and I think that we saw it in the governor's election as well.
Talking to Avner Zarny about a rightward trend in Wisconsin politics and how that'll play out in the spring elections. Avner, we know one pretty sure outcome of the spring election. There's one candidate, the incumbent for the Supreme Court slot, somebody who's generally referred to as in the conservative majority there. So that's probably a win for Republicans and conservatives. Let's look at the superintendent of education race. Tony Evers, generally viewed more sympathetic to teachers and on the Democratic side of things, opposed to Republican initiatives related to school choice. What do you see playing out in that race?
once again, you've got Tony Evers. The Republicans have two viable and credible candidates running in the primary election. Dr. Holtz, who was an award-winning school superintendent, retired school superintendent, and Mr. Humphreys, who is a school administrator at the moment, and I think it's in Dodgeville. So at any rate, they, as you say, they're very definitely on the other side of the divide from Mr. Evers. Mr. Evers has been very sympathetic towards the teachers' union, and therefore towards the public schools. Both Mr. Humphreys and Dr. Holtz have made very clear their support for school choice, for the idea that there has to be some sort of competition established in order to allow people to be able to make a reasonable choice about where it is to send their children, that their children aren't forced to go to a potentially substandard public school just because of the neighborhood that they live in.
And Avner, you see this rightward trend in Wisconsin in your piece on PJ Media. We've got it linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. You see this as for the benefit of the state. How is Wisconsin benefiting, as you see it, from a rightward trend?
Well, I think that there's little doubt that the last Doyle administration left the state in quite a bind. We had a $3.6 billion budget deficit. That's unconstitutional in the state of Wisconsin. Spending was going up and up. Businesses were spiraling out of the state. There were numerous businesses that left, numerous others that threatened to leave. One of the major reasons was because of that piece of legislation that was passed again in the last Doyle administration that required any business headquartered in Wisconsin that operations outside of the state to be doubly taxed. It was clear that the Democratic side had run out of new ideas, and so consequently, when Mr. Walker came into office with a whole set of campaign promises, he did something very refreshing. He actually kept them, or he tried to, and kept as many of them as he could. Perhaps the one rash promise that he had made was that one about creating 250,000 jobs, because it's not the government's business creating jobs. It's the government's business creating an environment to create jobs, and the federal environment has something to do with that, too. Nonetheless, he was able to balance the budget. He was able to do it without raising taxes. We've been able to reduce the overall tax burden and at the same time keep the state functioning and keep it functioning quite well. I believe that the UW system has the highest budget it's ever had, for example.
We'll leave it there for now. Avner, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
That's Avner Zarmi, longtime Wisconsinite. He's semi-retired from the aerospace industry. We've been talking about a piece he wrote for PJ Media on the rightward trend in Wisconsin politics. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, last night marked the end of a chapter in American political history when President Obama gave his farewell speech in Chicago. We'll talk about the highlights with a presidential expert.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Carol Dunbar and her family live off the grid in northern Wisconsin. It has its challenges, but those challenges have provided important lessons, too.
We stand guard at our stations. Me at the kitchen sink, my son by the front door, and my husband outside by the electrical box with the dog. The front door is closed because it's 24 below. Ready? Husband shouts from outside. Ready? Son calls to me. Ready, I say from the kitchen. Ready, my son relays. Pumping, shouts my husband. Pumping, echoes son. No water, I call back. No water, says my son. Turn it off, I say. Turn the pump off. The lights flicker. A buzzing courses through the walls. The phones go dark, and we lose all power. My son and I are screaming, "Turn the pump off!" The dog is barking. "Pump off," says husband. We all bow our heads and wait 30 seconds. Then we do it all again. It's been over 2 weeks since the pump worked for more than a few minutes. Every day, our holding tanks run out of water. I've been melting snow and filling jugs, placing bowls under faucets to catch every drop. We've been without running water before. For the past 14 years, our family has lived off the grid south of Superior. We generate electricity, pump water from a well. If we lose our lights, it's because our engine is down, our battery's low, or a mouse has chewed through the wires. We've gone long periods without running water, the worst being 3 months during winter when our kids were under 5. Now, they help. We have it down like a drill. Pack snow, melt snow, pour it in the buckets. Our soup kettle filled with snow yields 1 cup of water. The average toilet requires 56 cups to flush, or 4 hours of melting. Late January, the well digger comes with our replacement pump. The apparatus responsible for our water is surprisingly elegant. Does water really come out of there? It seems wrong that something so precious would come so easy. I turn the handle. Water flows. 3 days later, I watch on the news as villagers in faraway places walk miles to fill their jugs. The Save the Water organization says that over 1.2 billion people have to scramble daily to get their water. In the aftermath of no water, an unspoken reverence fills our house. At the sink, my husband uses a bowl to catch the runoff when he rinses his hands. My children never throw away the water left in a cup. Instead, they pour it in a bowl for the dog and pat his head. They know. Every drop counts.
Carol Dunbar is a writer in northern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now the word elites has become one of the dirtiest words in American politics. Over the course of history, it's an idea that has been in place since the days of the founding fathers, who worried about an arrogant British king heaping abuse on ordinary Americans.
Today, the term elite and its prevailing definition have mostly been claimed by the conservative movement, with watershed moments coming in a 1964 speech by Ronald Reagan and in this attack ad aimed at Democrat Howard Dean.
What do you think of Howard Dean's plans to raise taxes on families by $1,900 a year?
What do I think? Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking, sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading,
body piercing, Hollywood loving, left wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs.
Got it?
Club for Growth PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Beverly Gage is a historian at Yale University. She recently wrote about the history of the word elites for the New York Times. Beverly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot. That's great to be here.
So looking back at that Howard Dean ad that we just heard, how does that fit into our idea of who the elites are?
Well, I think for a long time in American history, you know, the idea of an elite was of a group of people who held a lot of formal political power. Today, it tends to be more the idea of a cultural elite or a coastal elite or a liberal elite, people who have the kind of attributes that you saw listed there. They like sushi, they drink lattes, they drive Volvos, and that tends to be more of a cultural class, really, than a social class, necessarily.
Why is this such a powerful word to level at someone in American politics?
You know, that's one of the mysteries that I kind of wanted to get at in the piece that I was writing, that there, in some ways, the word elite is still a compliment. So when you use it as an adjective, you say, you know, that's an elite athlete, that's someone to aspire to be. But when it's used as this noun that you're an elite or the elites, it tends to sort of evoke this idea of people who are disconnected from ordinary life, people who like to tell other folks what to do, and that's really become its political meaning.
Now, if you look at the 2016 election, and you point this out in your piece, that Donald Trump has a private jet, billions of dollars, an Ivy League education, but he does not consider himself one of the elites, and it seemed like a lot of voters agreed with him, so why not?
Right. Well, that is, again, one of the great political mysteries of our moment, that Donald Trump, who actually far more than Hillary Clinton was born to wealth, really had his path paved for him and has always been relatively insulated. He is not described as an elite, and he certainly doesn't describe himself as one, but says, you know, Hillary Clinton definitely is one. And I think it's partly because that term has come to designate a political ideology, that liberals are elites or elitists, while conservatives can't possibly be. And also that, you know, Trump was someone who kind of rejected a sort of expert knowledge, a kind of, you know, the kind of know-it-all college professor in favor of the telling it like it is American people. That was his story anyway.
Now, there are some critiques embedded in that cultural definition of the term elites that, yeah, people on the left have identified with and said, yeah, maybe there are some things there that liberals need to own. I mean, do you think that the liberal movement has ever really looked in the mirror and taken to task whether or not they consider that to be something they need to think about?
Right. Well, that is going to be a sort of interesting conversation over the next few years. I mean, if it is a conversation that develops, because like many political stereotypes, there's some measure of truth in all of this, right? And I think the place that it probably has the most meaning is in the idea that people tend to be kind of resistant to technocrats or policy elites who sort of look at things on paper and design policies for other people's lives without actually then reaching out to and getting to know the people whose lives this is going to affect. So that may, in fact, be a conversation that emerges, and that kind of conversation might actually be a productive one.
And you say that the term elites, it's got a lot of cultural currency today, but it seems like it goes all the way back to the founding fathers. So how did they see it?
Right. Well, so the founding fathers understood themselves to be rebelling against the concentrated power of a kind of monarchical elite. And then you've seen a lot of different populist rebellions of one sort or another throughout American history. So the Jacksonians, when Andrew Jackson came into power, they were rebelling against the founding fathers because at that point the founding fathers had become the kind of entrenched elite. And we saw this, of course, again in the late 19th century with the movement, the populist movement, that really gave us the word populist as a formal political category.
Was there ever a backlash against the prevailing idea of who elites were throughout the pages of history?
Well, there have been people who have critiqued and debated who deserves to be called an elite. So, say, in the 1950s and 1960s, sociologists, professors spent a lot of time trying to puzzle out who was a real American elite. Probably the most famous book from that moment was by a sociologist named C. Wright Mills, who wrote a book called The Power Elite. And to him, the power elite were all the people who were in charge of these giant new institutions that really were defining American life. So from the military to the government to the big new universities of the post-war years. But they were people who held real power. They made a decision. That decision affected other people's lives. And I think the puzzle now is how a kind of liberal professor at University of Wisconsin at Madison might be labeled an elite, but Donald Trump, a billionaire who is president of the United States, says that he's not one.
Well, Ronald Reagan seems like he was among those who birthed the word elites as an icon for the conservative movement in 1964. How did Reagan use that word?
Right. Reagan, I think, is really the person who crystallized elite as a cultural term, as a cultural idea. And for Reagan, you know, the cultural elite were, I believe he used the phrase, distant bureaucrats in Washington. Again, this idea that there were a bunch of people who were only interested, who went to the same schools, who were only interested in talking to each other, also known as the liberal establishment in that moment. That's who Reagan was really evoking when he used the word elite. And that's really the vision that has stuck, I think.
Does this word have a corollary that's used effectively by liberals at this moment in history?
Well, that is a really interesting question. So there are certainly plenty of choice words that liberals are throwing, both in the direction of the Trump campaign and in the direction of the conservative movement at this point. At some point in history, one of the favorite words for liberals that was intended to kind of evoke this isolated elite sense was plutocrat, right, or a plutocracy or an oligarchy, right? So that used to be much more a part of our political language. I think today that doesn't have quite as much meaning.
It's not quite as catchy.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't really resonate with us anymore. And so I think a lot of the epithets going the other way, there are many of them, but I don't think they evoke quite the same image. Maybe the one percenters is the closest that we can get.
Beverly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Beverly Gage is a historian at Yale University. She recently wrote about the history of the term elites for the New York Times, and you can read that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, President Obama gave his farewell speech last night in Chicago. We'll look at what he had to say, hear a little bit of it, and ask for your thoughts as well. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, there's a lot going on in national politics this week, and a special from the NPR Politics podcast team is going to help break it down, from the Senate confirmation hearings to President Obama's farewell address. That's coming up tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, President Obama said goodbye to the country last night as his term as president comes to a close and President-elect Donald Trump prepares to take office. The speech was an emotional one, especially when he addressed his family, but Obama didn't shy away from pressing policy issues that are being debated on Capitol Hill right now.
The speech also had warnings as the president talked about the state of democracy, what threatens it, and what he thinks will preserve it. Barbara Perry joins us now. She's a professor of ethics and institutions and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back.
Pleasure to be with you as always, Veronica.
Well, Barbara, overall, what did you think of last night's farewell speech?
I thought it will go down in history as classic Obama, and I mean that in the best sense, that he's known, of course, as a great orator, came on the scene as such, and will depart the public scene and his official scene as such. And I think this will go down in history along with Washington's farewell and Reagan's farewell, to tell us not only what they accomplished, but the things that we have to think about as we go forward in our country at the founding period for Washington during the Cold War and Reagan's case, and during a time of great uncertainty in our country and in the world right now.
Is there anything that struck you as unusual about how the president chose to use the time that he had there to talk last night?
It was unusual in the very setting that he chose to give it. As most people probably know and can remember from the most recent farewell addresses, they've been pretty sedate affairs from the Oval Office, which, give it that certain heft to come from the Oval Office, but it's also very staid. So to have a rousing 20,000 people in a big arena, again, really tied us back to Obama's coming on the scene and on the stage, the national stage and then the world stage, first in 2004 and then in 2007, 2008. So that in of itself, I think, made it different from more recent addresses of this type. And I think because we're in unusual times, and particularly in the aftermath of the Trump election in November, I thought the very moment that the president started to speak and used the term lame duck to say, in a joking way, I'm a lame duck, and he had been saying to people, please sit down, please now quiet, and no one did, and he says, I'm a lame duck, no one's following me. And I thought that was a little bit of a shot across the bow, perhaps, of the Mitch McConnells of the world, who tried to paint him as a lame duck 11 months ago when Justice Scalia passed away, and therefore the Senate didn't take up the confirmation hearings of Merrick Garland. And then the second line, the president stated, not unusual for a president, but to say, my fellow Americans, and I noted that he ended the speech as he went into his conclusion with that. And I thought that might have been just a bit of a poke in the eye of Mr. Trump to say, not only am I American, but I am addressing my fellow Americans here at the end.
Now, there's an ongoing battle on the Hill right now over Obama's signature piece of legislation, the Affordable Care Act, and he talked about that last night in his speech. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Health care costs are rising at the slowest rate in 50 years. And I've said, and I mean it, if anyone can put together a plan that is demonstrably better than the improvements we've made to our healthcare system that covers as many people at less cost, I will publicly support it.
And what do you make of that particular piece of his speech last night, saying that if someone comes up with something better, he'll support it? Does that sound like a challenge to you?
It does, and I had also watched the president's interview with two correspondents from Vox, the online news organization that the president did with them on Friday afternoon at Blair House across from the White House with a small audience of people around the country who had been a part of Obamacare in some states, signing people up for so-called Obamacare. And he said the same thing, and I was struck by it on Friday, and I guess he either had that thought or his speechwriters helped him to have that thought, and so he talked about it on Friday, and then he talked about it in his farewell speech. And I think it is a challenge to the opposite party now in the majority, certainly in the Senate and the House, and now in control of the White House, to say, I understand you're going to try to repeal this. You now have the numbers to do so, but I'm waiting for the second R. I'm waiting for replacement to follow repeal. Do you really mean that you're going to replace it? I hope so, because we don't want to leave those 20 million people behind who are now covered under the Affordable Care Act who might not be if it's repealed. And the president reiterated again last night, I will be the first to step forward and to support that replacement program if it covers those people and it does so more efficiently and more cheaply.
We're talking with Barbara Perry right now from the University of Virginia's Miller Center, talking about President Barack Obama's farewell address out of Chicago last night. And you've mentioned a couple times during the night where he seemed to take a bit of a jibe at somebody else there, to take a little bit of a dig at the next incoming administration, a change of parties there. And I wonder if you think that's unusual. On the other hand, you know, he did talk about the peaceful transition of power.
I thought he did it gracefully, as Obama is known to do. And in fact, when people booed when he mentioned President-elect Trump, he cautioned them not to do that and said that the American people should, he does, the American people should support the peaceful transfer of power in this country from one president to the next. And I believe that that is what he means. But I just thought maybe I'm reading too much into it. And again, it's not unusual for a president to say my fellow Americans. But I just took a bit of the irony from his saying that, given that the very person who's going to replace him on January 20th is someone who doubted his very American citizenship.
Now, Obama also said that the idea of a world that had moved into a post-race period was never accurate, and that was something that was talked about shortly after his election the first time. But he said last night that that was never accurate. It was time to broaden the idea of diversity. And here's what he had to say.
For blacks and other minority groups, that means tying our own very real struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face. Not only the refugee or the immigrant or the rural poor or the transgender American, but also the middle-aged white guy who, from the outside, may seem like he's got advantages, but has seen his world upended by economic and cultural and technological change.
Barbara, what's your take on that little bit of the speech that we just heard there, in particular the reference to the middle-aged white guy?
I thought that the president was speaking to the left and to the right side of the spectrums on that, and to state a truism that the concept of post-racial America may never happen because race is so embedded in our history and our consciousness, not that we shouldn't strive for that. But it would be a bit like saying that we had come to the end of history when the Cold War ended. I never understood that when some historians themselves would say that. So I think you stated a truism. But I think that reference to the middle-aged white guy, and I thought that was an interesting choice of words. It was a bit slangy, if you will, a bit informal to refer to the white guy. But I'm wondering if before November the 8th that line would have been in this message, this farewell address. But I say it's to the left and to the right because we know that both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders were appealing to some middle-aged white guys who have seen, as the president said, their worlds upended by globalism and the changes going on in our country and in the world.
Barbara Perry is with us right now. She's the director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And we're recapping some of the highlights of President Obama's farewell address in Chicago last night.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you thought of President Obama's farewell address. Did anything surprise you or stand out to you? What do you think about what he said about issues like health care, like race and diversity, like the transfer of power and his warnings of possible threats to the future of democracy, of representative government? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Barbara Perry, Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And we're talking about President Obama's farewell address in Chicago last night as President-elect Donald Trump prepares to take office.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to the farewell speech? What did you think? What did you think about the tone and the message? Are there any issues that you wish he had talked about that he didn't? And what do you think of President Obama's accomplishments, his legacy in his presidency, and his warning as he left about threats to democracy, to representative government in America and around the world? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Barbara, there were some clear references last night to legislation out of the states that could wind up before the Supreme Court. Things like voting laws, redistricting, that's an issue at play in Wisconsin. And the president said, when voting rates in America are some of the lowest among advanced democracies, we should make it easier, not harder to vote. And he went on to say, when Congress is dysfunctional, we should draw our congressional districts to encourage politicians to cater to common sense and not rigid extremes. Who do you think that section of the speech was intended for?
I think it was intended for the broad audience. First of all, to opponents of the president and opponents of the Democratic Party and those who might be opponents of certain voting blocs in this country, particularly minorities. Because certainly some people on the left and in the Democratic Party and among a liberal persuasion believe that the seeds of the Donald Trump victory and the Republican sweep this past November were sowed in state legislatures that began to move towards what some would call voter suppression in a more neutral way, something like voter ID laws, for example, or closing down voting places and causing long lines to form and that sort of thing. And voting redistricting has always been a controversial point between parties, as long as we've had parties going back to the founding, and just after George Washington, a nonpartisan left office, we ended up with our two parties. So redistricting has always been a controversy. It's ended up before the Supreme Court before, often in reference in the 60s, 40s, 50s, and 60s to race, and it continues to do that. So I think it was his staking his ground. I'm sure this is something that, as a citizen now, come January 20th, as he returns to the private citizenry, he will work on these issues. And I think it also then linked to his conclusion about being involved and being an active citizen and getting out and voting. And even, as he said, pick up a tablet, pick up a clipboard, and get out there if you don't like what's happening, and run for office yourself.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Terry joining us from Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
I wanted to say that I thought Obama's farewell speech was encouraging, and also I only recently kind of started getting involved with, you know, politics and stuff like that after Trump's election here, and I don't think we're going to see the end of President Obama. I find it encouraging that he's still going to be moving forward and being involved in issues. And I think he's still that very important rallying cry that a lot of liberals and progressives and Democrats will need moving forward when it comes to organizing and continuing, you know, to fight for issues that affect everybody.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call. And Barbara, I want to ask you about that. Toward the end of the speech, you were getting at it some of those comments just a moment ago about lacing up the shoes, picking up a clipboard, running for office, getting involved. And Obama said that he would be there, too, as a citizen. He used that word. Does that mean that you expect him to be more involved in politics maybe than other former presidents? Or what do you make out of that remark?
I think he is going to be more involved than even he thought and realized before November 8th. I think he probably thought that Secretary Clinton would win and that she would carry on his legacy at least for the next 4 years, and that he could go back to doing what he was particularly interested in before he became president, and that is something he did mention again last night, was community organizing. And this very week last year at this time, my colleagues and I from the Miller Center met with some of the leaders of the Obama Foundation, the Library Foundation in Chicago, those who are putting together his presidential library and the museum and the center that will go with it. So like most modern presidents, particularly since Jimmy Carter onward, they want to have a role. Some choose to go a bit underground, as George W. Bush did, but George W. Bush left with a low approval rating. Obama comes out of the White House with a high approval rating and will want to, I think, not only stay involved now in community service and pushing that agenda, but I think now he realizes with the Trump election that he will probably be more involved in trying to maintain his legacy for the near and distant future.
Thank you for that call, and we'll go next to Wallace and Weyerhaeuser. Wallace, hi.
After listening to this man's speech, you have to admit, what a statesmanship. He didn't demonize anybody, and what this man had to go through with the most obstructionist Congress and all the likes of Rush Limbaugh and all of these people who were demonizing him, how he handled it with so much statesmanship, I believe that his legacy is going to be very, very strong and all on the plus side. Thank you.
Wallace, thank you for that call. And Wallace, not worried about President Obama's legacy, what do you think he's looking at in terms of trying to stop Republicans from doing things they've wanted to do for a long time, like rolling back the Affordable Care Act? Do you think that legacy is in jeopardy?
I think we'll look at legacy in two ways, and one is legislation, as you're suggesting, with the Affordable Care Act, and if the Republicans make good on their promise, which they have every right to make in the campaign, and now that they're, again, if they have the majority on the Capitol Hill in Congress, and they have a one-party supporter down in the White House, they have that opportunity. Even so, I think that this talk of replacement, I've listened to a little bit of President-elect Trump's press conference today. He talked about replacement. The very fact that we're talking about replacing the Affordable Care Act with something else to cover these 20 million people who had not been covered prior to ACA, that in of itself is a legacy because, let's face it, those 20 to 30 million people had not been covered. And when the Clintons tried to do this in the 90s, it didn't work, and those people were still uncovered two decades later. So I think that will, even if the so-called Obamacare goes away, but if it's replaced with something else, the very fact that there has to be a replacement is a movement forward. And then the next part of legacy is to Wallace's point, which is statesmanship. I would add the adjectives to President Obama of grace and dignity. No scandals to speak of in his administration over 8 years' time. I think that he'll go down in history for those positive aspects. And I think, as most presidents, even Bush 43 rose in popularity and approval as time marched on. I think we will see that with President Reagan, particularly in contrast to the lack of some of those adjectives that will probably not be used to describe Donald Trump.
And Barbara, I want to ask you about something you said a little bit ago. You said that you thought President Obama would be more involved than he thought he was going to be in the next 4 to 8 years, trying to preserve his legacy, being active. What might that look like? How would a former president be involved? What kind of role would he have?
Right. I see it as one that will probably be out of the shadows. And to some extent, Bush 43 has done this model where he said, I'm not going to comment on what the next president is doing. And he's pretty much stuck to that. He's gone back to Texas, but through his foundation in Dallas, where I also just visited recently, and his library and his center, he takes on those roles that he feels comfortable with and those issues that he is fighting for. And I think President Obama thought he would perhaps follow that model and wouldn't need to be criticizing the next president. He thought would be Hillary Clinton. So I think that he's going to be more active, would be my sense, that he will be out on the speaking circuit, the more public speaking circuit, perhaps university settings, on talk shows as he was wont to do as president, and using his library and his foundation and his center in Chicago as a jumping off point, along with writing. Certainly he'll be doing memoirs, as presidents now do. On top of that, I suspect he'll be writing advocacy pieces, op-eds, articles, because, let's face it, he is a great wordsmith, and he is a professor by trade.
And as you said, Barbara, President Obama leaving office with high approval ratings and at a much younger age than most presidents. I mean, what do you think? You outlined the role that he may have. What do you think Americans would like to see at this point? Do we know?
Well, there will be those who would like him to fade from the scene, never to be seen again, if they opposed him at the time he was elected or came to oppose him. But he leaves office with an approval rating in the 55 to 57 range, depending on the poll one is looking at, and compared to President George W. Bush leaving with approvals at about 36%, Obama comes out more in the Bill Clinton, Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan category. So I think Americans who continue to support him, and you saw 20,000 of them gathered around last night, I'm sure there are many other in the millions who do, and I think that they will take great comfort from seeing him on the public scene because of his statesmanship and grace and dignity and intellect.
Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Veronica. I always enjoy it. Thank you for asking me.
That was Barbara Perry. She's a professor of ethics and institutions, and she's also director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And she joined us to talk about President Obama's final address to the nation in Chicago last night. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.